Hello and welcome to this discussion on the 2019 hurricane season. I'm Louis Philippe Caron, research scientist at the Barcelona Supercomputing Center. And with me today is Dr. Phil Klotzbach, research scientist in the Department of Atmospheric Science at Colorado State University. Hello, Phil.
Hi.
How are you today?
I'm doing very well. Thanks for having us.
I'm glad to have you here. And also with us today is Dr. Ryan Trochelat, co-founder and chief meteorologist at Florida Tiger in Tallahassee, Florida, and also hurricane analyst for the USA Today Network. Hello, Ryan. How are you?
Great. I'm looking forward to a great conversation about the season today.
Same here. So glad to have you both here today. There are two main topics I would like to discuss with both of you. The first topic is the 2019 Atlantic hurricane season itself. And the second is how well it has been predicted by the seasonal outlook. Does that sound good?
All right, yeah, lots to dig into.
Great. Okay, so let me start with you, Phil. Could you give us a brief overview of that last hurricane season?
Yeah, so the 2019 season, you know, I categorize it overall as being slightly above average. The number of storms was quite high. We had 18 named storms in 2019, and the average is about 12. So those named storms are any system that's named by the National Hurricane Center. But of those 18, only six became hurricanes. And those are winds of 74 miles an hour or greater. And we had three major hurricanes. Those are category 3+ on the Saffir-Simpson scale, winds of 111 miles per hour or greater. And so overall, the number of named storms is well above average, but the number of hurricanes and major hurricanes was the same as the long period average, which NOAA uses as the 1981 to 2010 average. A really geeky metric that we like to use to kind of overall assess hurricane activity in a season is what's known as accumulated cyclone energy. And basically what accumulated cyclone energy, or ACE, is it's basically an index that takes into account the frequency, the intensity, and the duration of storms. So very, very long-lived, intense hurricanes, such as Dorian or Irma, generate a whole pile of ACE, whereas very weak, short-lived storms like Olga generate very, very little ACE. So last year, the average is about 106 units are generated, and this past year was 130. So again, a little bit above average overall. The season got started a little bit early. It got started May 20th. The official start of hurricane season is June 1st, but that was Andrea, very short-lived, actually subtropical cyclone, which means it has some characteristics of a tropical cyclone, but also some characteristics of mid-latitude storms. And it ended in late November with Sebastian. Sebastian dissipated on November the 24th. Overall, the season got off to a very slow start. We were well below average through August. Then we had a very, very active September, the real headlining storm being Hurricane Dorian, which obviously we're going to talk about a lot more over the next few minutes. And in October, we had a lot of storms, but they were generally very weak and short-lived. So the number of storms is above average, but we actually had below average hurricane activity in October. Really, to me, the two kind of storms that overall headlined the season in terms of being very intense, very powerful, were Dorian, and then also Hurricane Lorenzo, which formed in later September and reached Category 5 strength, really far east in the Atlantic, the farthest east Category 5 Atlantic hurricane on record. So those, to me, were really the two storms that really did stand out. While we had six hurricanes, we actually were close to actually only even having four hurricanes. We had six hurricanes, but two of them only lasted 6 hours, which is basically the shortest period that hurricanes typically will last, just because the Hurricane Center does their standard advisories every 6 hours. Those two hurricanes were Barry, which was actually a hurricane making landfall, that made landfall in Louisiana, thankfully didn't do too much damage. And then we had Pablo late in the season, which was also a hurricane for just 6 hours. So while the ACE was really, really heavily generated, especially by Dorian to a somewhat of a lesser degree by Lorenzo. I think another thing that was really interesting about 2019 was the large number of really, really, really short-lived storms. So we had seven storms in 2019 that lasted 24 hours or less. And that's the breaks the record in the Atlantic Hurricane Database, which goes all the way back to the 19th century. The old record was six, set back in 2005, which many of you probably know was a phenomenally active overall season. So with these seven storms that were such short-lived, a lot of these storms probably would not have been named, certainly prior to the satellite era, which is basically since the mid-1960s is when we've had full satellite coverage in the Atlantic. And some of these storms may not have even been named 20, 30 years ago. We just have really significant improvements in technology that allow us to name some of these weaker storms that maybe we wouldn't have noticed or known about even 20, 30 years ago. One final kind of stat about 2019 I thought was interesting was that we had 14 storms in 2019 that generated less than 20% of the seasonal ACE, and the other four storms generated 80%. And just Dorian and Lorenzo generated 60% of the ACE. So you can have these years where one or two storms are really the drivers of these aggregate storm statistics. So I think this year is kind of a case in point where there really was no middle of the distribution. You had a whole pile of very weak, short-lived storms, and then you had a couple of really, really intense, powerful storms, again, Dorian and Lorenzo.
Okay, thanks. I think that's a very good summary. You mentioned that seven of the storms lasted 24 hours or less. How long did they have to last to be monitored by the and categorized in the IRDAP?
Basically, as long as there's at least one advisory that they call it a named storm, just as long as they give it a name, that's all it takes. But that hurricane database is generally done at 6-hourly time resolution. So normally 6 hours is the shortest amount of time that a storm can last, where it will still be categorized as a named storm. But we'll talk about Imelda in a little bit. But Imelda was actually named just 45 minutes before it made landfall.
Ryan, is there anything you'd like to add to this?
Yeah, just to echo Phil's point, I mean, I kind of think of this year as almost like a dumbbell or a barbell, where there's everything. You've got how heavily weighted with weak, short-lived systems that were generally not of much consequence. And then on the other side of the barbell, you were heavily weighted towards these two Category 5 events that were, ran up 60% of the season ACE on their own. And the other thing about the season that was true of last year as well is... is that a lot of the season was just concentrated into a short time frame right around the climatological peak of the season on September 10th. Between when Dorian formed in the last week of August and when Lorenzo dissipated right at the beginning of October, I did about 110 units of ACE in that 5 to 6 week period. And very little ACE before that in the season, and then October had a number of named storms, but they were generally short-lived and weak. So, another year where you have a year driven by a handful of powerful events that occur tightly clustered around the climatological peak of the season.
Okay, so I think we'll get back into this September month a bit later. But before we do, maybe we can just focus on a few of these terms that you guys mentioned. Let's start with Dorian. Ryan, do you want to tell us a bit about Dorian?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, Dorian really was defined the 2019 hurricane season. I think it's going to be the legacy storm, certainly from this year. It tied for second place for fastest maximum sustained wind on record in the Atlantic climatological data set going back to 1851, with sustained winds of 185 miles per hour on approach to the Bahamas. That also makes it the strongest Atlantic hurricane outside of the tropics. Tropics extending between the 23.5 south and 23.5 north, and Dorian hitting its maximum intensity north of those latitudes, technically in the subtropics. Now, Dorian, in many ways, is kind of a classic Cape Verde storm developed from a west-moving tropical wave in late August. Certainly nothing unusual about that climatologically. Developed to the east of the Lesser Antilles and didn't really look like much on approach to the islands, but it had a couple of center reformations, with the center kind of reforming further to the north. That allowed it to miss some potential land interaction with Hispaniola and also move into a more favorable environment in terms of outflow. It began intensifying rapidly as it passed by Puerto Rico, became a hurricane as it moved through the U.S. Virgin Islands, and then really continued to intensify as it turned back to the west underneath a ridge of high pressure and on approach to, what looked like it was going to approach the Florida East Coast over Labor Day weekend. Of course, what actually happened was that Dorian stalled over the northern Bahamas as it made landfall on Abaco Island as a Category 5 at peak intensity, 185 mile per hour sustained winds, and then stalled over Grand Bahama Island the next day, a 24-hour period of Category 5 intensity over Grand Bahama Island. And if you think about that, that's maximum. Those are sustained winds, and Grand Bahama was in the high wall, so they're in the radius of maximum winds. They're seeing the worst that Dorian has to offer. Now, you're talking about wind speeds equivalent to an EF3 or even an EF4 tornado sustained for a 12 to 24-hour period over a populated area. I mean, it's unimaginable. And the damage and destruction in the northern Bahamas because of that was cataclysmic, both, of course, from the winds themselves, but also the massive surge that was generated by those winds as well. I did some quick research.
Just quick interview here. Is it fair to say that this type of event where a location is under Category 5 for 24-hour nonstop is unprecedented in the Atlantic?
There's no precedent for that. There's no precedent for a Category 5 completely stalling as Dorian did, and not moving for a day or more. I did some quick research with Dr. Bob Hart at Florida State in the wake of Dorian, and we found that Dorian actually generated more ACE inside a basically 1 degree latitude by longitude box than a single storm has ever done in the Atlantic Basin. And the upper echelons, I think top two or top three ever observed in any global tropical cyclone basin, kind of the West Pacific, Indian oceans as well. 17 units of ACE in a 1 degree by 1 degree box for a single storm, and that is a populated box. That's a place where people live. That's why it was so devastating. It's fair to say that it was the hardest hit, probably one of the hardest hit places of any landmass that has ever been hit by a tropical cyclone in recorded history, certainly within the era where we have well-defined climatological records.
Maybe Phil or Ryan, maybe you can explain to the people listening why this is so unusual.
Well, a hurricane's energy source is provided by the warm waters of the upper layers of the tropical ocean. So typically when a hurricane makes landfall and it moves over land, it cuts itself off from its energy source. So a hurricane that makes landfall will weaken usually fairly quickly once it moves inland. It's also unusual for there to be truly no forward motion at all, especially for a Category 4 or Category 5 hurricane. So in this case, this is a special set of circumstances where Dorian stalls out over a populated area in the northern Bahamas, over Grand Bahama Island, but that is a relatively small island, so it's not completely cutting Dorian off from its warm water energy source. It's over the Gulf Stream. The Gulf Stream is continuing to transport very warm and deep water to the circulation of Dorian as it stalled. So while Dorian weakened over that 24-hour period, it was weakening from 185 mile per hour maximum sustained winds, which is 25 miles per hour above the 29 miles per hour above the threshold for Category 5 hurricane intensity. So it had a long way to come down, but that rate of intensification was slowed by the continued presence of warm water fuel to the majority of the hurricane circulation.
Okay. And was the U.S. impacted at all by Dorian?
Well, the impacts on the United States were relatively minimal. Despite Dorian stalling as a Category 5 hurricane 120 miles east of the Florida East Coast, Dorian was a relatively compact storm. Tropical storm force winds only extended out up 100 miles or so from the center. Hurricane force winds more like 30 or 40 miles from the center. So as it moved about 80 to 100 miles east of the Florida coastline after stalling over the Bahamas, that was far enough away for the Florida East Coast to avoid major damage. Nuisance-level damage was basically observed in Florida East Coast.
Phil, anything you would like to add to Dorian?
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, really, like Ryan said, I mean, normally these Category 5 hurricanes don't really grind to a halt. And obviously, I think one of the things that really was unique about Dorian is even if a Category 5 were to stall over most areas, even over islands, normally it would upwell. It's going to be, because it was such an intense storm, you have all this intense mixing going on. It churns up a lot of cold water, which generally would weaken it a lot faster than Dorian did. And that's because, as Ryan pointed out, you have the Gulf Stream just kind of constantly replenishing that warm water. So while it did weaken, I think there's not a lot of places in the world that you could stall a Category 5 and have it weaken any slower over land than where Dorian did. So it's just a really horrible set of circumstances that resulted in basically the cataclysmic damage that we've seen both in Abaco and in Grand Bahama.
Maybe the next storm we could mention is Imelda. Ryan, would you like to say a few words about Imelda?
Sure. I mean, Imelda is a storm that really emphasizes the risks at the other end of the spectrum of what can be dangerous and destructive about tropical cyclones. You know, Dorian's your windstorm. It's what people think of. It looks like a classic hurricane. It has a well-defined eye wall, a clear eye. You know, it's a textbook hurricane. You know, Imelda was a messy system that developed very close to land. It was a tropical wave that moved across the Gulf of Mexico, became a minimal tropical storm about 45 minutes before making landfall, with maximum sustained winds of only around 40 miles per hour. But unfortunately, the situation with Imelda was that as it moved inland into eastern Texas, it moved very slowly, and once it got inland, it stalled out. It very quickly lost any, you know, characteristics. It lost its sustained winds of 40 miles per hour, so it weakened to a depression, but it produced long-lasting torrential rainfall over communities in southeast Texas that have been hard hit, of course, by Harvey in 2017, and other heavy rain events in the last 5 to 10 years as well. So Imelda, despite being a tropical storm for only a very brief period of time, doing very, very little ACE, it's the costliest named storm of the 2019 season for the continental U.S., even higher than the damage the Dorian did to the Florida East Coast and to the Carolinas. Caused around $2 billion in damage, and it resulted in 5 fatalities, unfortunately, in eastern Texas. So, you know, people think of wind as the biggest risk from hurricanes, and of course, you know, not going to count that out for events like Michael and Dorian. But on the other end of the spectrum, you know, people, I think, underrepresent the risks or don't focus as much on the risks posed by heavy flooding rainfall that tropical cyclones can do, especially when they stall or move slowly for an extended period of time. I think the highest rainfall total I saw with Imelda was something like 40 inches of rainfall to the east of Houston. So that's honestly, it's remarkable that there were only $2 billion in damage and only 5 fatalities given the extent of the flooding and severity of the flooding.
Yeah, it's a lot of water. A lot of people are familiar with Harvey, of course, for this reason. So how did the Imelda compare to Harvey?
Well, Imelda did not produce as much rainfall as Harvey did. Imelda was a smaller, weaker system. It stalled for a shorter period of time. It was about 3 days versus Harvey's 5 to 6. Harvey's maximum rainfall was about 60 inches. Harvey also produced a much wider area of 2 to 3 feet or more of rainfall. That maximum total of 40 inches and the area of feet of rainfall was more limited in Imelda. So it was, you know, a $2 billion event instead of a $125 billion event as Harvey was.
So a small difference. Phil, do you want to say anything about Imelda?
Imelda, yeah, I mean, basically just reading Ryan's comments, I mean, it was just basically, you know, from an ACE perspective, from an aggregate statistics perspective, it was, you know, almost a non-event, but obviously it just emphasizes the fact that, you know, while some storms it's the wind and the surge, other storms it's the water, and certainly Imelda will be remembered as, you know, just a very intense flooding event. And again, the storm almost didn't get named.
Yeah, the National Hurricane Center was only giving it a 30% chance of developing into an organized system, even the morning that it made landfall. So, you know, it was something that kind of flew under the radar a little bit in terms of being a significant threat, but you know, had an outsized impact, certainly relative to its ace.
And then maybe the last storm that is worth talking about for the last season is Lorenzo. Ryan, could you say a few words about that storm?
Sure. So Lorenzo became a Category 5 hurricane further east than any other Atlantic hurricane on record. It developed from a tropical wave that moved off the African coast, and models locked onto it developing well ahead of time. Now, it turned north into the open ocean, well to the east of the Lesser Antilles, fortunately. So it was not something that impacted the U.S. or even impacted the Caribbean. But it was, it's notable for really, going through a rapid intensification event that actually led to its intensity being higher than what some of the theoretical predictions of what hurricane, quote, should be able to strengthen to at that latitude and location. And it really kind of draws attention to this mini trend that we saw again in 2018 and then in 2019 of unusually high tropical cyclone activity in the subtropics. So north of roughly 23 degrees north, you've kind of seen this trend towards your Florence's, your Lorenzo's, where there's just more intense hurricane activity happening further north than climatologically you would expect that it would. And it sent, this was a huge, powerful storm. It sent swells all the way across the Atlantic. So there definitely was a rip current and a swell impact on the continental U.S., even though Lorenzo stayed thousands of miles away, over 2,000 miles away from the U.S.
Phil, any words about Lorenzo?
Yeah, I think Lorenzo, as was briefly noted earlier, was very well predicted by the models, and it came, and it was a very, very large storm. I think that's kind of what really kind of normally storms, when they come off Africa, aren't necessarily particularly large in terms of their overall size. They make it pretty strong, but they're normally fairly small. Even a storm like Irma, when it came off Africa, was pretty tight and then grew with time. Lorenzo came off Africa and it was huge. It was just a very, very large storm. And I think its intensification to a Category 5, a lot of the models had it going up to a 3, and, it became a 3. And I remember I was out hiking the day that Lorenzo became a Category 5, and I was talking with my wife that morning and said, no worries. It's a garden variety Cat 3. Not much is going to happen today. The environment didn't look anything special. And we come back that night and it's a Category 5 hurricane. And it was just, as Ryan noted, so we have these kind of theories that given the overall kind of basically juiciness of the atmosphere in terms of the ocean temperatures and the overall structure of the atmosphere, this is how strong a storm could get. And Lorenzo actually was even a little bit stronger than what we thought it could actually possibly get. It had really pretty much an ideal environment for intensification, given the waters were warmer than normal, but not necessarily as warm as, say, what Dorian was going through. So I think, Lorenzo was certainly took, I think, a lot of people by surprise that it reached Category 5 where it did. And, just a really impressive an impressive storm that far east in the Atlantic Basin. Normally, you don't get Category 5s until they get further west because just climatologically, your waters get warmer as you move from east to west across the basin.
Okay, so we have three storms here. We have Dorian, which kind of stalled over Bahamas at Cat 5 for almost a day, which never been seen before. We have Imelda, which caused a lot of damage due to rain just after Harvey, which is also unprecedented. And we have Lorenzo, which formed at Cat 5, further east by a wide margin, further east than everything we've seen before. So are these just statistical anomalies? Is this something that we should worry about? Anything there?
Yeah, well, it's tough to establish long-term trends of rare events. And Category 5 hurricanes are very rare events. We've seen 6 of them in the last 4 years, but over the last century, I think we've only seen about 30, if memory serves correctly. So, it's hard to say whether or not there is a durable trend or a durable shift in where hurricanes are developing and intensifying, if there's a trend towards more of the most intense kind of storms. There's certainly theoretical arguments in favor of that, but at this point, we're left looking at a couple of pretty odd hurricane seasons in 2018 and 2019. It's gonna take some time to make sense of them.
Phil, you agree?
Yeah, and I mean, one of the challenges that we have is the stronger the hurricane, unfortunately, as you go back in time, kind of the more smooth the data set gets, and they tend to be more conservative estimates just because, you know, you think about a storm like Lorenzo, it was only observed via satellite imagery. I guess there was one plane that was flying into it, but normally, you know, you're not flying these aircraft into storms like Lorenzo that are that far east. And so as you go back in time, the satellite quality gets poorer. And so trying to estimate these storm intensities going back in time gets just, they're just less accurate and tend to be more conservative. So unfortunately, you know, if you're looking at, say, the number of named storm or number of hurricanes, you'll probably get that pretty reliably back to about 1950. But if you're looking at category fives and these borderline storms, it's a real challenge. And for example, if you talk about category five hurricanes, we have this record that goes back to 1851, the Atlantic Hurricane Database, but our first Category 5 hurricane is not recorded in that database till 1924. And obviously, we didn't go 70 years with no Category 5. We just didn't have the data to observe them just because all we had at that point was ships and land masses. So that's, I think, one of the real challenges when you're looking at, you know, these really high-end rapid intensification events, and when you're looking at Category 5 hurricanes, is that the amount of data that we have, where we have data of high confidence, is just unfairly short period, which makes kind of assigning confidence and trends more challenging.
Yeah, absolutely. Because even in a Category 5 hurricane, the area of actual Category 5 conditions is exceedingly small, and it'd be almost impossible to tell the difference between a Category 4 and a Category 5 unless you have observations from that tiny, tiny slice of area where those 160 plus mile per hour sustained winds are occurring.
So the fact that there's no Lorenzo in the database before is not necessarily because it's never happened, but maybe just because it hasn't been recorded.
Correct. Yeah, I mean, so in the case of a storm like Lorenzo, you know, given how large it was, I think we certainly would have known it was there. But in terms of knowing that it was, you know, a Category 5 as opposed to a Category 3 or 4, it's possible even, you know, in like the 1980s, we might have thought certainly it was a strong storm that may have gone down as a, you know, a mid-range Category 4 hurricane as opposed to a Category 5. I mean, just our satellite data now is so much better than it was. And so that really is that those kinds of improvements in technology lead to upward trends in storm intensity that aren't physical. They're just due to observational improvements. And so when you're looking at these long-term trends, you know, there's likely a climate change component, but there's also an observational component, trying to disentangle one and the other. We could spend several hours having another podcast just discussing those issues.
Okay, but let's not. Instead, let's move on a bit from these specific storms to more the overall conditions that were present during the 2019 season. So Phil, could you tell us a bit about the conditions that led to this above normal level of hurricane activity?
Yeah, so I mean, you know, so every year with the seasonal forecast, so our group at CSU have been doing these since the mid-80s, you know, and when you go back at the end of the season, we try to look and see, okay, you know, basically how much storm activity occurred, and then we look at the large-scale atmospheric conditions, because hurricanes, you know, are driven by large-scale atmosphere ocean conditions, and so in general, if the overall conditions are more conducive, you're going to tend to get more storms, especially in the deep tropics. And so when I was going back looking through, I was actually a little surprised to just see how low the vertical wind shear was in the tropical Atlantic. And so vertical wind shear is a change in wind direction with height in the atmosphere. And normally in the Atlantic, your wind shear in most of the tropics is out of the west, which basically means your upper level winds are blowing out of the west, and your low level winds in the Atlantic tend to blow out of the east. So you have basically a shear in the vertical, and too much of that shear is detrimental for hurricanes. It tends to tear them apart, promotes dry air mixing in, that weakens the thunderstorms. And so this year, the shear was very low. And if all you had was a map of the shear, you would have thought that it would probably have been a really active season. And so overall, storm activity, especially in the tropics, was near average. It wasn't even above average. A lot of the, as Ryan already talked about, we had a lot of more activity in the subtropics that kind of tended to increase the numbers more than what would have been observed just from what happened in the deep tropics. Sea surface temperatures this year were a little bit above normal. not record-setting, say, like in 2005 and 2010 when they were well above average. This year, they were just a little bit above average, a couple of tenths of a degree Celsius, which doesn't seem like a lot, but very small temperature changes mean a lot in the tropics. So half a degree Celsius, 1 degree Celsius, warm anomaly makes a huge difference, can make a big difference, not only just in terms of more fuel for the storms, but also in terms of how it then alters the large-scale circulation. For example, El Nino, which is one of these things that we talk about, and we'll get into more detail talking about El Nino in a minute. An El Nino event becomes declared by NOAA if the sea surface temperatures exceed the average by half a degree Celsius, or about 1 degree Fahrenheit. So these very small temperature changes do make a big difference. But even this year, they were just a little bit above average. I think really one of the things that kind of knocked down the season, given the shear and the fairly favorable water temperatures, was the fact that we had a lot of dry air. And several of the storms that we saw this year really definitely struggled with dry air. So dry air basically squelches the thunderstorms that are the building blocks of the hurricanes. And we had a lot of dry air this year. And I think I think the shear was conducive for a very active season. The sea surface temperatures were relatively conducive, but it was really the dry air that kind of squelched a lot of stuff in the tropics. And there may have been some large-scale circulation potentially related to even what was going on in the Indian Ocean that we'll address in a little more detail here in a few minutes. But really kind of to me, you know, what really defined the season and made it above average was these two storms that we just discussed, Dorian and Lorenzo. I mean, these two storms were by far the biggest generators of ACE, the biggest generators of the number of days of hurricanes and major hurricanes. And, you know, both those storms didn't really kind of ramp up until they got out of the deep tropics, they got into the subtropics, especially Dorian, you know, it struggled a lot with dry air. But then once it got into the subtropics, out of the deep tropics, got into a much more conducive environment. And so I think really, at the end of the day, it was the shear and the sea surface temperatures were certainly quite conducive to support an active season. And it was really kind of the dry air, especially in the deep tropics, that kind of kept the season from being, you know, maybe just a little bit above average as opposed to being, you know, a well above average season or something like we saw just a couple of years ago in 2017 where we had, you know, near record levels of activity.
So, Ryan, you agree with that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that the SST point, just to kind of dig in on that a little bit, you know, this was another year where, you know, in the summer months and going into the late summer months in August, you know, SSTs in the tropical Atlantic were still relatively cool. But as they have over the last couple of years, we saw a warming trend relative to normals going into September, the peak month of the hurricane season. So, you know, yeah, by the time the real peak was rolling around, now, 50% of hurricane activity historically in the Atlantic occurs in the month of September, with almost 35% just occurring within a two-week period centered on September 10th. Now, you had those SST conditions in place, and the shear conditions were relatively favorable. So you have to dig in a little more to try to figure out what happened this year and why your Jerrys and Karens, you know, that developed in mid-September in a climatological position where you might expect more intensification than you observe, you know, they fell apart after kind of, you know, meandering about in the central Atlantic. So, you know, there's definitely something to dig into there and unpack that goes kind of beyond, you know, SSTs and shear.
So Phil mentioned El Nino earlier. Was that a factor at all?
Not really in 2019. So NOAA had declared a weak El Nino event beginning in, I believe, February of 2019, and that event continued through the spring, never really intensified. A lot of the ocean atmosphere feedbacks that you typically see in a canonical El Nino event never really manifested with this particular El Nino event. The warm waters in the tropical Pacific, the equatorial Pacific, were well west, basically, of where you would see in a garden variety normal El Nino. And that warmth really started to moderate once we got into the summer months. NOAA rescinded their El Nino declaration. They declared it to be over, I think, in June. So by the time we went into the actual hurricane season, there was no longer an El Nino in place. the region that we monitor to determine whether El Nino is in place or not. As Phil mentioned, had retreated towards just true neutral conditions by the late summer months, or August and September. El Nino SAT anomalies were right at zero. Now, typically, the way El Nino modulates, El Nino tends to cause weaker or less active than normal Atlantic hurricane seasons, and kind of the medium through which that occurs is a higher shear over the western Atlantic, unfavorable upper-level winds that tear apart the convective activity that makes up tropical cyclones. And as Phil mentioned, that shear was not elevated in the western Atlantic in the peak of the hurricane season. Gulf of Mexico, Caribbean, tropical Atlantic, really all below average in terms of shear. So we did not see that El Nino effect in 2019. It really was not a big player.
So I think it was Ryan that mentioned earlier that all the activity for this season was really concentrated in a few weeks. Typically when that happened, we looked at the MGO for this kind of behavior. Phil, was the MGO a factor at all this year?
You know, really, it doesn't appear that it was much of a factor. So the Madden-Julian Oscillation is basically a 30 to 60, sometimes as long as 70-day convective or deep thunderstorm oscillation that propagates around the equatorial tropics. And as it does so, it alters both kind of levels of vertical motion as well as changes in things like vertical wind shear, mid-level moisture. And in the Atlantic, really, we find the signal is really big, especially in vertical wind shear modulations where you can get significantly reduced shear and then significantly above normal shear. And the Atlantic shear is climatologically is marginal. It's a really marginal basin. And if you increase the shear above the average, it can really kill the season. But if you can reduce it, you can really, really amp stuff up. But this year, if you look at kind of the canonical indices that a lot of people use for the MJO, it was fairly weak. There was an amplification of the index in late September and early October, but some of that amplification of the index was likely actually forced by what's known as a very strongly positive Indian Ocean dipole event, which we'll discuss in a lot more detail here in a minute. And that's basically, we just had a lot of forcing coming out of the Indian Ocean. But that forcing out of the Indian Ocean likely did actually potentially reduce the shear and really help make conditions conducive for Lorenzo for its development. But overall, the MJO really didn't seem like it played much of a role. Perhaps late in the season, it actually did get stronger. And as it propagated around the globe, it tends to actually be in phases that were not particularly conducive for the Atlantic Basin during mid to late October. Because given the shear pattern, you would have expected a much more active end of the season than we actually ended up with. We had, again, a bunch of storms, but generally they were very weak and short-lived. We didn't get any of the kind of canonical nasty hurricanes coming out of the Western Caribbean in October like we sometimes get, especially when the shear is reduced like it was this past season.
So Ryan, Phil just mentioned the Indian Ocean dipole. Could you expand on this a bit?
Sure. I think this is a key point because I think the Indian Ocean dipole really was a major driver of some of the unusual patterns of tropical cyclone activity that we observed globally in 2019. Just to backtrack for a bit so people know what I'm talking about here. Indian Ocean Dipole is basically the gradient in sea surface temperatures, or SST anomalies, between the western half of the Indian Ocean, more towards the Arabian Peninsula, and the eastern half of the Indian Ocean, more towards Thailand and Indonesia. So a positive Indian Ocean Dipole, like we had in the fall of 2019, means the western Indian Ocean is very warm, and the eastern Indian Ocean is cooler than it normally is. And I think, as Phil mentioned, we have the strongest positive Indian Ocean dipole that we have ever seen on record, certainly in the last 50 years since the satellite era anyway. That Indian Ocean dipole event really started to spike. It went from a normal positive Indian Ocean dipole to really a record-setting event here in September and then into October. So I mentioned odd patterns of TC activity in 2019. Well, as an example of that, hurricanes, tropical cyclones, they're known as cyclones in the Indian Ocean. But this has been a record-breaking year in the Indian Ocean, in the northern Indian Ocean, because the western Indian Ocean has been so warm. We've seen tropical cyclone activity about five times normal in the Indian Ocean. I mean, that's just, you know, it's insane. It's insane how far beyond anything that we've observed, this year has been in the Indian Ocean, because those waters are so warm and conditions are so favorable for convection. And the IOD really has this kind of global pattern of rising and sinking motion that it tends to engender across the tropics, especially in a year like this one where the IOD is not, it's typically associated with, you have positive IOD when you have an El Nino event in place, but that wasn't the case in 2019. So kind of had this pure positive Indian Ocean dipole pattern of rising and sinking motion in the tropics. So you have this huge rising branch in the Indian Ocean, where we have a lot more rising air mass than you would expect to have in the western Indian Ocean. You have that air kind of moving laterally along the top of the troposphere, the tropopause, and then kind of sinking across Indonesia and Australia, and suppressing tropical cyclone activity for a big portion of the year in the western Pacific. You had a rising branch, another kind of rising branch that fell into place across the subtropical eastern Pacific, although SSTs in the eastern Pacific were kind of marginal this year, so it wasn't a big year there. And then you sort of had this sinking branch, again, across the Caribbean and portions of kind of the tropical central Atlantic. So if you look at the track map for the 2019 hurricane season, it's basically empty in the southern Gulf and the Caribbean. You had a couple storms, Dorian and Karen, that clip across the eastern portion of the Caribbean, but nothing in the western Caribbean, nothing in the central Caribbean, very, very little in the southern Gulf of Mexico. And that is something that, you know, the scientific literature that studied these kind of canonical, ENSO-independent relationships globally of rising and sinking air masses, it tends to line up with what we observed in 2019. As much as real world events can and do sometimes line up with theory, it seemed to kind of it did obey those kind of theoretically identified relationships.
I'm going to geek it out here for a minute. Do you know if there's any modeling study where atmosphere-only studies where the IOD positive pattern has been imposed on the SSTs and keeping the rest, you know, climatological value, and look at the impact on tropical cyclones in the Atlantic?
I don't know of any studies that specifically study IOD in relationship with the Atlantic Basin. The study, Saji and Yamagita, that I'm referring to here, it was an observational study. It wasn't a modeling study. So, yeah, I mean, I think it's certainly an interesting something for further investigation to try to probe how the IOD has a relationship with Atlantic activity. I mean, typically the IOD is not this strong, and the weaker events tend to have more of a localized relationship, you know, certainly with monsoon strength in the Indian Ocean, precipitation patterns across Southeast Asia and Australia and Africa, but less of a global impact. So, I mean, to see this kind of, you know, it's rare to have these kind of global impacts, because disambiguated the forcing from the El Nino forcing that kind of confounds some of the observational studies.
Well, maybe a paper waiting to happen there. Okay, so moving on from the 2019 hurricane season to seasonal outlooks, basically trying to answer, oh, well, we managed to predict this hurricane season. So maybe for the people who are not familiar with seasonal outlooks, these are quite different than typical hurricane forecasts, where we don't try to predict specific storms, nor where they will occur, nor the timing, but it's more a forecast of the overall activity of a given season. So, Phil, how well did we do this year?
Yeah, so we actually have a website that LP helped or LP Negre of Barcelona really got the stuff underway there, and so we have a website where we actually have over 25 different groups submitting seasonal forecasts to this website every year. And so of those
sorry,
groups, our group see it. Oh,
sorry, maybe what is that website?
Okay, so the website is seasonalhurricanepredictions.org. And so that website, we have about 25 different groups submitting seasonal forecasts. And so on those on that website will be our forecast from CSU, Ryan's forecast from Weather Tiger, and a whole pile of others that range from private weather companies, which we only allow groups that have credentialed meteorologists on them, as well as public our universities. And then we also have government agencies. And so if you look at those seasonal outlooks and kind of look at the average of those and what actually ended up happening, the forecasts this year were pretty good. You know, it was if you look at the overall ACE that was predicted, it was a little bit lower. Most groups forecasted very close to a near normal number or near normal ACE. And the hurricane number was also quite close. The average with the August forecast, which is just prior to when the season really historically ramps up, was 7 hurricanes, and we ended up with 6. So overall, I would say the seasonal forecasts this year were quite good. There wasn't a ton of spread in those forecasts. A lot of the overall climate conditions were pretty close to what you would expect with an average overall season. Our group at CSU, the April forecast that we had was a little low. We actually went a little bit below normal, and that was primarily due to the fact that we thought maybe the weak El Nino that was in place during the winter and spring was going to persist, and that didn't happen. So in June, we upped our forecast a bit. And overall, the our forecast in June and August were for a number of hurricanes, were quite good. We forecast 6 in June, 7 in August. We ended up with a total of 6. ACE, we were a little bit low by about 10 or about 20 ACE units, and that's or 20 to 25 ACE units in that was, again, due to the fact that we had Dorian and Lorenzo generated a whole pile of ACE. So while the overall number of hurricanes and major hurricanes, again, was near average, the ACE was a little bit high. And so that's kind of why our hurricane and major hurricane numbers were pretty good, but the ACE was a bit low.
And what about you guys at Weather Tiger?
Well, overall, our forecasts were a bit of an under forecast at all lead times. But we're a little more aggressive in April. I came in with an ACE number about 105. In June, we upped that to 120 ACE units. And then we pulled back in August to around 90 for reasons I'll get into, I think, in the next prompt. But overall, April hurricane numbers, 7 in June, 6.5 in August, so very close to observations. ACE numbers somewhat under-predicted, but we went a little more bullish, especially in April and June, and got pretty close there. So not too bad, a little on the low side overall.
Yeah, so I think on their website, Weather Tiger had the best April forecast of all the groups that submitted the forecast at that time of the year. But then you went and you changed it, you lowered it. So maybe you can speak a bit as to why you did that.
Sure. So our initial forecast in the spring, we run an in-house ENSO modeling algorithm, basically, that was indicating that the odds of ENSO or this weak El Nino event falling apart or kind of being of a flavor that wouldn't have much of an impact on the Atlantic, was going to play out. So we were predicting the demise of El Nino by summer, and that's what happened. So that's, I think, why we started a little bit higher than some of the other forecast groups, had a little bit of an edge at the beginning of the year. And in April and June, our August forecast dialed things back a little bit because basically we were looking for more warming of the tropical Atlantic in June and July than was actually observed. So in early August, we're still looking at a main development region of the tropical Atlantic that's pretty significantly cooler than normal. And we weren't really seeing a lot of indication that that was necessarily going to change in the next couple weeks leading up to the peak of the season. So we dialed it back then. Also, trade winds at low levels were a little bit quicker than normal across the Caribbean and the MDR in July. That tends to be a pretty good leading indicator as well. Interestingly, despite dialing back our expectations for ACE, we do run a separate predictive algorithm basically for probabilistic landfall risks for the continental U.S., and those really did not recede much, if at all, between June and August, despite or ACE projections dialing back a little bit. They're still indicative of likely due to the proximity of the warm water in the subtropics and closer to the continental U.S. that there was still risk, elevated risk relative to normal for U.S. landfalls.
And so, Phil, so while Ryan was dialing down this model, you were increasing.
Yeah, so the main reason we increased our forecast a little bit was, well, there were two factors. One, there was a little bit, so we talked about, and so one of the things that we noticed was obviously we realized that El Nino likely was not going to persist. So that's one of the reasons we increased our forecast. And also we did see just a little bit of anomalous warming in the tropical Atlantic from June to August. And also one of the other things I did want to mention is we built with a ton of help from LP and the Barcelona folks, we built a statistical dynamical model, which basically uses the ECMWF climate model to forecast large-scale conditions that go into our August prediction. And that model tended to be a little bit more bullish on the season than some of the other statistical work we were doing. So that's another reason why I think we increased our numbers. But again, they didn't come up a ton, just a little bit when we thought El Nino was likely to when we thought El Nino was likely to go away.
And what about the other groups? How did they change their forecast as the season was getting underway?
I mean, a lot of these groups, you know, didn't change their numbers very much. You know, NOAA increased their numbers. They were going for an average season, and they went to a slightly above average season from June to August. And you know, NOAA had a really good seasonal forecast. Their August forecast was really good. Overall, they got the numbers pretty close. Again, everybody was way low on the number of storms, but, you know, basically when we do these seasonal forecasts, we're generally trying to kind of assess, you know, overall what's the activity going to look like. And if you say, okay, slightly above average, well, a slightly above average season normally has, you know, 13 or 14 storms, something along those lines. And if you end up with a whole real pile of these really, really short-lived storms, it gets really hard to forecast that named storm metric. But overall, I would say, you know, NOAA did a really good job with their seasonal outlook this year. And a lot of the other groups did too. I mean, a lot of groups were forecasting near to slightly above average. And again, you know, that's how the season played out. Near average again for number of hurricanes and major hurricanes, and a little bit above for ACE.
So then, reflecting back on this season, Phil, is there anything you learned this season that will help you improve your model for next year?
Yeah. So one of the things that we're going to be doing, one of the things we're going to be doing is putting a lot less emphasis, or somewhat less emphasis, on the dynamical forecast of El Nino, especially during the spring. For example, the European Center model, the last few years has been just really bullish about El Nino, and it really hasn't panned out except for 2015. So it's tended to be pretty aggressive for warming, and we just haven't seen it for whatever reason. So I think, you know, still looking at those, but not necessarily putting as much stock in those, doing a little more of our own kind of statistical analyses on the ENSO. And the other thing that I just briefly alluded to earlier is we did have last year our first, or this past hurricane season, the first run of our statistical dynamical model. So we're going to be, you know, that one did pretty well this year. So we're going to certainly be using that again in 2020, hopefully with a few improvements as well. So I think really, you know, the other thing I guess too is, you know, to see what we can see about the subtropics. So that's, you know, it's hard to say. Again, it's been 2 years, but something we want to take a look at is, you know, is how predictable is the subtropics? Is it just effectively noise, which some papers came out in the 90s kind of saying, yeah, that it's not very predictable, or maybe there are some signals that, given the large-scale warming, that we might be able to use. So I think those are kind of some areas that we're going to be, you know, doing a little bit of looking into.
And what about you, Ryan? Any lesson?
Well, I definitely echo Phil's last point there, because, you know, some of the objective ways that you might assess the 2018 and 2019 hurricane seasons ahead of time, you know, they didn't seem to really predict the outcomes that we got in 2018 and 2019. You know, there seems to be sort of this, you know, in 2019 you had this area of anomalous sinking air over the Caribbean and, you know, dry air over the tropical Atlantic, but you kind of were able to migrate that activity north of its traditional, you know, stomping grounds, basically, over the heart of the hurricane season. Yeah, and that was true of 2018 as well, certainly. you kind of defied some, leading indicators that would make you think that maybe this isn't going to be a particularly active season. So, looking if there's some way to quantify, and especially to quantify probabilistically, some way of indicating that there may be a shift in the places where hurricanes develop, and just because the conditions are unfavorable over some of the more historically active areas doesn't mean that the basin as a whole is necessarily going to be quiet over the course of the season. To get into the philosophy of the science a little bit, you always have to communicate your forecasts probabilistically as a range of percentiles. Hopefully, or best practices, you're going to be reporting, what you're making a prediction that's out of sample. You're not using the same data to generate your model as you are to make the prediction, basically. And you're going to go back and backtest and see what your errors would have been over time. So those kind of define your expected error intervals, and communicating that information to the public, I think, is and doing it in a way that's understandable and gets through that there's certainly a huge component of inherent uncertainty caused by short-term environmental parameters or even inner core dynamics of strong hurricanes that really do have a big impact on the cumulative ACE outcome of the season. Now, if you think about this 2019 hurricane season, but instead of turning into a Category 5 and stalling over the Bahamas, Dorian goes over Puerto Rico and Hispaniola, weakens and dissipates, and it does, 10 units of ACE instead of 50. Suddenly it's not an above average season. We're near the median or even below the median. And, that's really, I think that's something that it's an example that shows that, the individual events, especially these rapid intensification events, can really have an outsized impact on the overall outcome of the year from these energetic metric perspective.
Okay, thanks. And maybe a last question for you guys, maybe starting with you, Rich Ryan. Is there any feature of the 2019 season and maybe the few seasons that came before that that might point to trend for the 2020s?
Well, it's kind of an odd last decade of hurricane activity in the 2010s. You had a chunk of seasons at the beginning of the decade which were active but had very little landfall activity. You had an inactive period between 2013 and 2015 driven by El Nino. And then between 2016 and 2019, kind of had this period of mean reversion where you had a number of U.S. threats as well as four above-average seasons in a row. What's missing there is the kind of the middle tercile historically. You didn't have seasons that were between roughly 65 and 120 units of ACE, and the average season is 100 to 105 historically over the past 30 or 50 years. So you're kind of the center did not hold in the 2010s. You had very inactive years, and then you had above average years. You were kind of missing that median chunk. I don't know that that's going to persist into the 2020s, but we certainly did see some of the. There's an extent to which you can define trends as being somewhat statistically durable, and then there's an extent to which you need to wait for rare events to occur to make those calls, basically. But some of the ways that you might expect hurricane activity to change in the next the next several decades are increased proportions of rapid intensification events. Rapid intensification events reaching higher maximum sustained wind thresholds, potentially slowing a forward motion of hurricanes, as well as increasing the rainfall that you get from slow-moving systems approaching land. And of course, 2019 kind of contained the multitudes of those longer-term trends with rapid intensification events like Dorian and Lorenzo, stalling events like Imelda and Dorian, and then those heavy rain events like Imelda that impacting eastern Texas. So certainly would not be a surprise to see those trends continue into the 2020s.
And what about you, Phil?
Really, what stood out to me in 2010s is you know, we had a period from 2006 to 2016 where we went through an 11-year period where we had this major hurricane landfall drought where we had no major hurricanes hit the continental U.S. And those, again, are winds of 111 miles per hour or greater. We certainly had some very impactful storms like Ike and Sandy, but no major hurricane landfalls. And then we went to 2017, where obviously it was an incredibly active season where we had, you know, both Harvey and Irma hitting the continental U.S. and then obviously Maria in Puerto Rico. But really, I have to say, overall with the decade, I feel like the U.S., while certainly not saying didn't have any significant impacts and a lot of damage, the continental U.S. got really lucky, especially the last few years. If you think back at 2017, I mean, obviously Harvey was horrible, but Irma, you know, it was a Category 5 hurricane, you know, and for a while it was forecast to be a Cat 5 hitting Miami, and then it was going to go up the coast and hit Tampa. And, you know, I mean, it still obviously caused a lot of damage in the U.S., but certainly was not a nearly a worst-case scenario had it not hit Cuba and tracked a little further west up the coast. It could have easily submerged pretty much all of Naples and Fort Myers and just been a tremendously devastating storm. 2016 with Matthew, I mean, that storm was caused a lot of damage up into the Carolinas and some damage in Florida, but certainly had that been just 100 miles further west and scraped up the whole northeast coast of Florida, you know, and certainly with Dorian this past year, I mean, obviously it was a certainly 100% worst-case scenario for Abaco and Grand Bahama, but for the U.S., it did end up being, it was, you know, caused some damage, but certainly not nearly what was feared a couple of days out. So I think, again, we certainly, you know, we, at the end of the day, the 2010s, I think, were a decade where the U.S. effectively got lucky in that we had some damage, but certainly not nearly as bad as it could have been had these storms played out slightly differently. So, you know, at some point, unfortunately, these kinds of strings of good luck sometimes don't necessarily continue forever. So, you know, there's certainly still the potential that we could have, you know, a storm that's going to make the damage that we've seen in the last decade or so look small compared to what we could see in the future, even without climate change impacts, just due to the increases in population along the coastline. And then obviously with climate change, potentially even more from that.
Yeah, you know, it's strange to think, or specifically regarding Irma, of a storm that did $75 billion of damage and caused hundreds of fatalities as a relatively good outcome, but it was. I mean, it certainly was. You know, Florida did not have a hurricane landfall of any variety between Wilma and Hermine in 2016, which is an 11-year unprecedented period. And at the same time, you had huge population growth, you know, in there. The east coast of Florida in the 2010s didn't see a single hurricane landfall. They had close scrapes from Matthew and Dorian, but there wasn't a single storm against, you know, you would expect around three basically per decade to impact the east coast of Florida. South Florida in particular has just been extraordinarily lucky. They avoided the worst of Irma. Dorian stalled 100 miles to the east and didn't really have major impacts there either. You know, that luck's not going to hold out forever. If you look at hurricane history in Miami, South Florida generally, you know, the 20s through the early 60s were incredibly active relative to what we've seen in the past, 15 years post Wilma here. So, that's certainly something that I, I'm concerned that luck will run out in the 2020s.
Okay. Well, on these grim thoughts, maybe we can wrap it up. Unless Phil, you would like to add something?
No. I think that's good. I mean, I think we obviously covered a lot of ground and. Yeah, it's been great geeking out and talking hurricanes.
Yeah, I think it's a good place to leave it. So before wrapping up, let me just thank you both. So thank you, Phil. You can find the CSU seasonal forecast at www.tropical.colostates.edu, and you can find Phil on Twitter at Phil Klotzbach. So thank you, Phil. And also thank you, Ryan. You can find Ryan on Twitter at WX_Tiger. Ryan, would you like to say a few words on Weather Tiger before we go?
Sure. Weather Tiger, we're a weather consulting firm that basically we try to merge the best of predictive analytics and big data with understanding of the ocean atmosphere system. We use those to make seasonal forecasts for hurricanes as well as temperature and precipitation. We do forensic meteorology and expert witness services, and we provide agricultural and hurricane forecasting solutions to enterprises large and small. So Find out more about us at weathertiger.com if you're interested. And again, thank you to Bill and LP for having me as a guest today. It's been a great conversation.
Well, thank you very much to both. Finally, a reminder that you can find all seasonal hurricane forecasts for the Atlantic at www.seasonalhurricanepredictions.org, as it was mentioned before. So thank you, and hopefully we get to do this again.